This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. A week into the globally popular Olympic Games being held in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, much buzz has emerged in the news and social media about the racism and sexism of media commentators. But there's also been a celebration of the diversity of medal winners. Brazil's own political chaos and economic disasters have also garnered attention, mostly because Brazilians themselves have braved repression and used the world stage of the Olympics to denounce a parliamentary coup taking place in their country. Signs of Fora Temer, meaning out with Temer, are sending a clear message to the interim president Michel Temer and the man who's leading an impeachment of Dilma Rousseff. My guest is Dave Zirin. He is a sports editor for The Nation, author of Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down, and his new book is called Brazil's Dance with the Devil, The World Cup, The Olympics, and the Fight for Democracy. A new Olympics edition of that book is just out. Welcome to the program, Dave.
Oh, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So we've been covering the coup, if you will, as it's being called, the parliamentary coup against Workers' Party's Dilma Rousseff quite a bit on this program. But with the Olympics has come greater international attention. How remarkable are the efforts by Brazilians to, you know, hold up continuously these signs of Fora Temer all through the Olympics? Many people are being dragged out of the stadiums, but they're getting on cameras nonetheless.
Well, it's really interesting because the opening ceremonies of the Olympics included a 15,000 person march calling for Dilma's return and for calling for Temer to leave. They do these opening concerts for the Olympics like they do for every Olympics. And the crowds in the concerts were chanting Fora Temer, and even some of the artists were chanting Fora Temer. And then something even more remarkable happened. In the opening days of the Olympics, as you said, people were holding up these Fora Temer signs, and they were getting dragged out of the stadiums, or they were being detained by the military police. But then a judge issued a ruling saying that anybody who pulled anybody out of a stadium or anybody who removed a sign from anyone would be subject to a 10,000 reais fine. That's about $3,300. It's a lot of money. And since then, people have been able to hold up the signs without being pulled out of the stadiums. Now, this judge's ruling is a remarkable rebuke, and it's a rebuke not only to the Temer government, which of course it is, but it's a rebuke to the International Olympic Committee, which really wanted these kinds of laws on the books so that there would not be any politics interfering with the games.
Now, in addition to what's happening inside the stadiums, are there protests still continuing outside? Are Brazilians, and are Brazilians also torn between maybe a sense of national pride that they're hosting the Olympics and this anger towards what's happening in their country politically, or is it fairly focused against the coup?
Well, I was at a protest against Olympic removals just on Saturday, so the protests are still going on, and there are protests ongoing against police violence and displacement, and these protests are linked to the Olympics and the kind of agenda that the Olympics bring to Rio. They're not getting a lot of coverage, but certainly these are going on. Currently, there's a favela called Favela Horto. That's H-O-R-T-O. And I'm spelling that so people can know the name of this favela because they are one of the oldest favelas in all of Brazil. It's over 200 years old. And its residents, which include over 600 families, have been given 90 days to vacate. And this has all happened while the Olympics are going on, but because it's not happening anywhere near an Olympic venue, it's gotten next to no publicity whatsoever. As for national pride, I mean, we have to separate this into two questions. There's pride in Rio, and then there's pride throughout Brazil. I do think, and this question is very much affected by class and by social and economic inequality, because in Rio itself, the games, especially the main staging area, I mean, it takes over 2 hours to get there unless you live in this wealthy neighborhood called Baja. And so if you're somebody, just a regular person who lives in Brazil, in Rio, I should say, even if they give you a free ticket, the expense of just getting there on public transportation makes it prohibitive, or if even having the time to spare makes it prohibitive. So as far as for the folks who live in Rio, for poor people, working people, it has the feel of people who have their face pressed up against glass when it comes to these Olympics. And in the country as a whole, 60% of the country in a recent poll, as reported by the New York Times, said that they wish the Olympics were never going to be there. But that being said, we also have to remember that Brazil is a country that has a great deal of wealth. It's over 200 million people. It's a country that's larger than the continental United States. And certainly thousands of people from across Brazil are traveling to Rio for the Olympics. And most of the people in the crowds of the venues that I went to were in fact Brazilian, and they were proudly wearing their Brazilian colors.
Hmm. Now, Dave, you've written a lot in your book about how the government of Brazil struggled with paying for the Olympics. And we know that in Rio, you know, before the Olympics, soon before the Olympics, we heard about the city declaring bankruptcy, and still the leaders were determined to show a brave face to the world. How has just hosting the Olympics exacerbated Brazil's already precarious financial situation?
Well, it exacerbates it in ways big and small. It exacerbates it in the most grand way, because when you're spending between $12 and $20 billion on the Olympics, and there are real shortages in education and in health and in infrastructure, well, then that on a very macro level is something that anybody can see. You don't need an advanced sociological degree to see that and feel that. On the micro level, there are reports about hoarding that's taking place at hospitals to make sure that there's enough life-saving medication available and ambulances available for foreign tourists at the expense of the people who live there. There's stories about like most basic issues around sanitation, around making sure that there are hot lunches in schools that aren't happening. And the Olympics, of course, are looked at because of the issues of priorities. But I mean, let's remember that nobody in Brazil thought this would be the case. When they were awarded the Olympics, Brazil was regularly on the cover of The Economist. They're the neoliberal dream country. The Lula, the social democratic president, Dilma's predecessor, was referred to in the Financial Times as the IMF's favorite president. And all of that has just gone down the hill. Yeah. And yet what's so pernicious about the International Olympic Committee is that they don't care if your country's in crisis. They don't care if you're having these other shortfalls. They have been promised these commitments when it comes to things like security and infrastructure, and they are insistent that those commitments are filled no matter the social cost.
Right. Now, very recently, during these Rio Olympics, the American multiple gold medalist Ryan Lochte was essentially robbed with some of his fellow Olympians while traveling from one part of the city to the other. And, you know, the reactions have been quite remarkable, from blaming him for being out to blaming Brazil for being a crime-ridden country. How should we view the fact that there is crime in a poor country?
I mean, there's crime in cities across the world, and it is something. I'll tell you one thing. I was in Brazil, I was in Rio. That was my last day when that took place, and the news reports publicized it by saying people dressed up as police officers held up Ryan Lochte and friends. And all the Rio folks, the Cariocas, as they're known, laughed and said, what do they mean, people dressed up like police officers? Those were probably police officers. Like, the idea that it was criminals masquerading as police officers was comical to them, because that's not something that's uncommon. The idea of police holding up foreigners, holding up people, clearly wealthy people who are in town. And usually what they do is they drive them directly to ATMs and get them to withdraw money. So in a weird way, Lochte might have gotten off easy in this regard. But what was also so remarkable, as you alluded to, was the reaction of the IOC, which was the first to say, no, it didn't happen. even though Ryan Lochte's mother said it happened. They basically called Ryan Lochte's mother a liar. And then that really bizarre reaction by the head of Brazilian security, who said, well, they shouldn't have been out so late outside the security zone. What a terrible statement that is, because what does that say about the millions of people who actually have to live outside that security zone? What does it say about how much their health and safety is cared for? And look, I'll say it, you know, I've been to Rio a ton. It is, of course, a dangerous city. It's also a beautiful city. It's a city that has given so much to global culture. And that's just part of life in a profoundly unequal society. Like, to me, like the real issue is that if there's such a gap between rich and poor, like, I get so angry when people talk about Brazil being a quote unquote developing country, as if that's the root of the problem. I mean, the issue is not development. There is so much wealth in Brazil. There are so many billionaires in Brazil. There are so many malls that would make malls in Beverly Hills and South Beach look meager by comparison. So the issue is not development. The issue is where they choose to invest resources. And anytime you have a country that is so heavily built on oligarchy, those resources are going to always be weighted towards the top 1%.
And now you have also, Dave, written a lot about issues of race and gender in sports. And speaking of a profoundly unequal country, one of the things that was really celebrated during the actual goings on inside the Olympics was the win by Rafaela Silva, the first woman from favela to win a gold medal in judo. How important was this symbolically for Brazil?
So important. I was outside when this took place, watching that in a field, in a free zone, where there were like big screens where actual regular folks from Rio could come see it. And people were crying when she won. I mean, people were so moved by this. And yet even this story was colored by Brazil's prejudice, tragically, because so many of the stories, so much of the media put out by Brazil's media conglomerate, Globo, which is just like, imagine if right-wing Fox News ruled the United States and was like the only media outlet for the mainstream. That's what Globo was like. All of the stories were about celebrating Rafaela Silva at the expense of her favela home, City of God, as if the real miracle is that she was able to avoid the pitfalls of City of God, when in fact she was trained as a judoka at an institute in City of God. And she grew up with the support of her family in City of God and the support of her friends in City of God. That's not to say City of God is an easy place, and that's not to say that her accomplishment is not utterly remarkable. But if anything, the lesson that should be drawn from it is this is what happens when you actually invest in City of God. Because so many of the poor in Brazil, in Rio, in the favelas, in City of God are viewed as expendable people. Are viewed as even human trash with nothing to offer society. And here's Rafaela Silva, and she proves on the largest possible stage how absolutely fraudulent that idea is. And yet the media there still takes it and turns it into a story to further back up the prejudice that City of God is so awful, instead of looking the opposite way. Right. But people in Brazil, people in Rio in particular, they knew the truth. And anytime you talk to somebody, they talk with so much joy, so much love about Rafaela Silva. It really was a special moment. And then to have her tell the world that she's part of the LGBT community after she won her gold, is that you now have a black lesbian woman in Brazil who's their highest star. And in a country that certainly, you know, like our country, has issues with racism and homophobia and all the rest of it. I mean, it was a very powerful moment.
Also, very powerful moment on the world stage of the Olympics were wins by other black women. The U.S. gymnastics team has really been very powerful. Some are saying that this might be the Olympics where we've had more women of color take center stage and win gold medals than before. I'm not sure if that's true. Is it, Dave, as far as you know?
Well, I don't think we can have the numbers statistically down yet.
Right, we're still in the middle of the game.
And of course, as we learn in Brazil, of color means different things in different countries. Like my friend who lives in New Jersey in Brazil says that She's black in New Jersey, and then she flies to Brazil, and all of a sudden she's white, and how she's treated is entirely different.
Right.
So different countries measure African descent in different ways. But all of that being said, even though I don't have the numbers and we don't have the numbers yet, I certainly cannot remember an Olympics with when you think of everybody from Simone Manuel to Simone Biles, it really is something remarkable. Allison Carter, the first American woman, black, white, whatever, to win the gold in the shot put, the daughter of an NFL player, Michael Carter, who, by the way, played for the San Francisco 49ers out there in the Bay. So a little bit of Bay Area love there. It is really nice always. And so you do have this remarkable tapestry of women of color, and not merely from the United States either. We mentioned Rafaela Silva, and certainly we could also talk about the Jamaican women and the women from the Bahamas who've performed so beautifully. And then, I mean, this is not to inject a man into it, I apologize, but Mo Farah of England, of Great Britain, to win the 10,000-meter gold after falling down. I mean, it's so unbelievable. And not only did he fall down, but to have Mo Farah do this in the wake of Brexit and all the anti-immigrant sentiment in Great Britain. But the bigger issue is, like, when you have this, like, I was in Great Britain for Brexit earlier this summer. I was there reporting, and the anti, whatever people think of it here, please know that the anti-immigrant sentiment in London of people who voted for it was so intense, and it felt like the entire sections of the city were like one big Donald Trump rally. And so to have Mo Farah win the gold, I mean, these become political statements unto themselves, no matter how harmful the Olympics are on a host city.
Right. And then what have you made of the mainstream media coverage of some of these powerful women in particular that have won?
Yes.
There's been a lot of criticism because a lot of women have
sometimes
been discussed in the context of their partners, their coaches, their husbands, etc.
I have to tell you, like, I'm shocked by it because obviously sexism is still alive and well in sports. And we can say that by so many metrics, from the amount of time devoted to women's sports coverage, when they're on the cover of magazines, things like that. But I really thought we'd move beyond the whole, oh, and here's the man responsible for a woman's athletic triumph, which was so prevalent. With these games, and particularly, like, with for some reason in swimming, like, very intense sexism in terms of how the female athletes are discussed. And I really did think we were past it. My naivete is there for all to see, I guess. And I think that, not to sound like a broken record, because I feel like I've said this so often over the last many years, but when you don't have women behind the camera, not in front of the camera, but behind the camera, helping to make these kinds of production decisions, you're going to keep having these problems.
Right.
This is why diversity matters, not just faces in invisible places, but the people who are actually doing the production and the planning of these events. It's going to be lopsided as long as power is held in a small group of hands.
Right. Diversity in newspapers would be nice as well. The San Jose Mercury News came under fire for having a headline that said, "Olympics, Michael Phelps shares historic night with African American." That was...
Oh, my God. And that's horrifying. And there was another one, too. I wish I could call out the paper, but in big letters, it said Michael Phelps wins silver, and then very small underneath, Katie Ledecky sets world record, wins gold. So, and it was so perfect because it's like bigger type for his silver than not only for her gold, but for her world record.
Right.
And it's just, you think we're past this. And every time you think we're past this, there are these stark reminders that we're not. And maybe in some respects, we should be thankful for the reminders because it tells us the truth about the kind of fights we need to wage.
Finally, Dave, there was recently this remarkable photo series of abandoned Olympics stadiums around the world for, you know, over the past decade or so. And it's likely Brazil's stadiums may end up that same way as well. How deep a price do host countries pay for hosting the Olympics? Is it ever really worth the price?
No, it's never worth the price in its current form. That's just the sad truth of what we're talking about here. It's never, ever worth the price. It could be worth the price. And there's so much joy and beauty that we get out of this that it certainly could be worth the price. But I got to tell you, the problem is that wherever the Olympics go, they bring debt, displacement, and the militarization of public space. These are the addictions of the International Olympic Committee. And the only way we're going to break the IOC of these addictions is if more and more host cities refuse to host. It seems to be the only thing that they listen to are when cities actually, like Boston, like Chicago, and hopefully like Los Angeles in the lead up to 2024, if they don't stand up and say, we're not going to accept your terms, your mafia-like terms for what we have to do to host these games, we're going to keep having to deal with this.
Dave, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. And I apologize for my exhaustion.
No worries. Dave Zirin is sports editor for The Nation, and he's the author of Brazil's Dance with the Devil, The World Cup, The Olympics, and The Fight for Democracy. The Olympics edition of that book is just out. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.